Good evening, folks. 6:09 in the Twin Cities, 86 degrees. Obviously, an extraordinary amount going on. You know, I was just chatting with Jonathan Lowe, our studio coordinator, as well as Eric Nelson, who did just a fabulous job with the breaking news out of London. If you are just joining us, there is some sort of attack there. The reports of a truck plowing into people on the London Bridge. There are injuries. There have been stabbings. There may be a second scene. This has all been developing within the past hour and a half. CBS News will keep you updated. We're going to take the CBS update at 6:20 here. But we want you to know that we are on top of that. But we do have a lot of local events and news to talk about. And one of the biggest events, obviously, that just really got underway this week was the trial of Geronimo Yanez, who is the man who shot and killed Philando Castile. We know that. The question is, did he do it in terms of his capacity as a police officer, feeling that his own life was threatened? That is what he is arguing. However, he has been charged with manslaughter. Joining us right now is one of my favorite people to kind of get the lowdown and the insights into the way our legal system works, Joe Tamburino, criminal defense attorney. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
All right, absolutely. As you see it, let me ask you, first of all, Officer Yanez is not charged with murder. He's charged with manslaughter. What kind of difference does that make?
Sure. Manslaughter means that you did not intentionally want to kill the other person, or you did not premeditate the killing of the other person. Rather, you did it in a negligent manner, such as, you know, you did an act that was so negligent that someone died. Manslaughter also includes heat of passion, though that's not this case. Heat of passion means, you know, say all of a sudden you find your spouse in the throes of infidelity and you attack the other person. That would be like a heat of passion. But what he's charged with is the negligence part, culpable negligence.
All right. In general, it's pretty rare, isn't it, for a police officer to be charged in these cases. There have been a lot of controversial cases. He's charged. How unusual is it?
It's extremely unusual because when a prosecutor gets a police officer shooting, the first thing they have to think about is the standard is different, as it should be, if a citizen just tried to protect themselves with a firearm. If you and I tried to protect ourselves with a firearm, the standard is a reasonable person. With an officer, it's a reasonable police officer in that situation. So it's not just that anyone could say, well, I acted in self-defense. It's a reasonable police officer in Officer Yanez's situation. So that's why a lot of these cases do not get charged. And if they do get charged, you know, it's very rare.
All right. And they've gone through the jury selection process and they're kind of waiting through that. And they still have not completed, you know, getting a jury. I guess it's difficult. And I know that the defense tried to move it out of St. Paul. It's really hard to believe that somebody hasn't made up their mind about this, even somebody who's maybe not that tuned into the news, because the exposure with that his girlfriend's streaming it live on Facebook, that video has been everywhere.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons probably why the judge didn't move it out of Ramsey County, because in today's day and age, it doesn't matter if you're in Bemidji or Rochester or St. Paul. We all have the internet. We all have computers. We all have TVs, radio. So it really doesn't matter where you are. You're going to be bombarded with this information anyway. But what you have to try to get to are people who, even though they may have heard something about the case, they can still keep an open mind. And that's what you've got to try to do.
Or even if they've seen the video.
That's right. Even if they've seen the video. Because I've done dozens and dozens of jury trials, and I think a lot of time when people become jurors, they really do try hard to say, you know, no matter what I heard outside in the world, I'm going to try to put that aside and just listen to the evidence. I think most people really try to do that, and that's the kind of sincere juror that you want on any case.
In terms of, and how important is that seating of a jury and that jury selection process? Because they're obviously taking time over this.
It's very important. That's why it took about a week, because the jury decides what the facts are. The judge gives the jury the law. The judge says, here are your instructions at the end of the case to determine manslaughter, to determine dangerous weapon discharge, whatever it is. But the jury decides what facts are true or proved and what facts have not been proved. And that's the whole thing about the case. Without them, you wouldn't get guilt or not guilt. So it's extremely important who you pick as a jury.
All right. In terms of the average person's belief about police officers,
right,
how much is that going to be a factor? Because I think it's very difficult, I think, for most people who have enormous respect, as we all should, for police officers to carve that out.
Right. Well, from the prosecutor's side, you want people that have not had bad experiences with police officers and people who can always remember that every day when a police officer goes out on his or her shift, their lives can be in danger. That's what you want from the prosecutor's side. From the defense side, you want someone who may have had a bad experience with a police officer, or you want someone to say, police officers are completely human beings and they can commit crimes too. So those are the two sides of this coin, and that's what they're both trying to get.
Right.
And right now what they're doing, well, what they finished, is trying to weed out the people of the jury who might have had either some bias or prejudice against one side or the other. And then on Monday they will start doing what's called a peremptory strike.
Okay. And how does that work, the peremptory strike?
Pretty simple. What happens is, on almost all cases except capital cases, cases that involve life imprisonment, each side gets a number of strikes. From the defense side, they get 5 strikes. The state side gets 3 strikes. So starting on Monday afternoon, Officer Yanez's team will get to remove 5 people out of that pool. And from the state side, the prosecutor for Ramsey County will get to remove 3. Sometimes you will have both sides agree and the judge approve more strikes, but that wasn't the case here. They're just going by the standard number.
All right. And going back to that video, the Facebook video, which obviously is going to be played, and we've heard it again. It's been played as, you know, preview stories are done. I know that my colleague, one of my colleagues interviewed you for a preview story.
Right.
When you go back to that video and you hear it, there's no question this police officer is not in a calm position as he addresses Diamond Reynolds, the girlfriend of Mr. Castillo. He is obviously incredibly agitated and incredibly upset.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, you just hit on something that I think both sides will argue to their benefit in closing arguments at the end of this trial. Because from the prosecutor's side, you will argue that he was in such a state of fear and apprehension that he had his voice cracking and he was very nervous because he really thought his life was in danger. That's what the prosecutor is going to argue. The defense is going to argue that the reason why he sounded so nervous and the reason why his voice was cracking was because he can't believe he just shot this man when he didn't have to. So again, it's the two sides to the coin. But it's very good that you pointed that out, because his demeanor and his voice and the cracking could work both ways.
Interesting.
And
okay.
Both argue it.
Right. Because, you know, he kept on saying, and then he's actually arguing with Ms. Reynolds, saying, you know, I told him to put it down. She's saying, no, you didn't. And she is super calm.
Right.
And it's
right.
Just it's a shocking video. It's one of the reasons that it went viral, is because it's so horrifically dramatic.
Right, and we're going to see if the whole video is going to be played, because the defense, remember, is trying to keep out all information about Mr. Castillo having a permit to carry. And the prosecutor wants, well, that to come in the video. So we're going to see if the whole video is played. The judge has, I don't think the judge has made a decision yet on that.
All right. And the penalties for manslaughter, I mean, if there is perhaps a conviction, which we obviously don't know, where
right.
are they?
48 months. Under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, manslaughter in the second degree, which is what he's charged with, and if he's convicted of that, is 48 months in prison if you do not have any priors. A judge is allowed to do what's called a departure. So in rare circumstances, a judge could say, well, I know the prison is called for 48 months, but I'm not going to do that. But that's very rare. Normally, if you get convicted of this, it's 48 months, which is 4 years in prison.
And in terms of, you know, the barrier for the prosecution, what do you think is their toughest challenge?
Their toughest challenge is to show that he did not act as any reasonable police officer would in that situation. And that's a really big hurdle to jump over, because already the prosecutor has to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But when you're prosecuting a police officer, what happens is you have basically extra proof that you have to give the jury.
All right. And Joe, if I can ask you to hang on here, because we're just getting word of a special report from CBS News on this incident in London. We'll be back with Joe Tamburino in just about a minute. But right now, the report on what is happening right now in London from CBS News. And we will keep you updated throughout the evening on that incident in London as we get more details. My apologies to Joe Tamburino, criminal defense attorney. I did not mean to interrupt you, sir, because we were just getting your take about what the prosecution has their biggest challenge. If you can kind of finish your thought, and then also what the biggest challenge for the defense is.
Sure, no apologies necessary. This is horrific in London. I mean, I've been to that city. We love that city. Actually, my wife and I will be back there again in November. It's horrible.
Oh, it is horrible. Absolutely.
Unbelievable. Yes, the biggest challenge for the prosecution is to convince a jury that this police officer did not act as a reasonable police officer would in this case, which is a very high, high bar to get over. From the defense side, what you have to show is this police officer was in fear of his life, and he did what was necessary to protect his life. The prosecutor is going to point out things such as this, that there was a woman in the car who posed no threat, and that there was a child in the car who obviously posed no threat, and that Mr. Castile said, hey, I have a firearm. Didn't mention he had a permit to carry, but he has a firearm. So those are all things you're going to support that he didn't act reasonably. And the defense is going to say, you can't look at all that. You have to put yourself as a reasonable officer in his shoes. And when someone says they have a gun, the heat gets turned up.
Right. In terms of this case, is there anything that really stands out to you, aside from the fact that obviously this extraordinary video, but are there any things that people should watch for? I mean, there's been so much tension around this. You know, protests have shut down Interstate 94. I mean, it's really been an extraordinary case.
There's four parts to this that are going to be very important. The first is, what is going to be the evidence on the use of marijuana? Number two is going to be, what is going to be the evidence on the permit to carry? Three is going to be if Officer Yanez testifies, because when a defendant testifies, if the jury believes the defendant wins. If the jury does not believe the defendant loses. When you get testimony from a defendant, it is that important. And lastly is going to be the closing arguments.
Okay. And the marijuana use, obviously that has already been out there that Mr. Castile had been using marijuana.
Right. Right. This is the kind of case, I think, and I don't know what the judge is going to do, but if I were the judge, I would let the marijuana in and I would let the permit to carry in. Because in a case like this, I think you err on the side of giving the jury all of the facts and let both sides argue the facts weight rather than keep things from them. Because both sides are well armed with their attorneys. They both have good attorneys on either side. So I would say, you know, the marijuana, that could come in, the permit to carry, that could come in, the video, that could come in, and then give the jury all the information to make an intelligent decision.
Let me ask you, because Mr. Castile did have a legal permit to carry, and so he informed the officer that he did have that permit to carry. What is your advice to clients or people you know who do have that permit and who are probably, like all of us at some point in our lives, going to get pulled over by police officers, you know, for a minor traffic incident?
Right. I think all he said, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think what Mr. Castile said is that he had a firearm, not that he had a permit
right.
to carry.
Right. That's my understanding as well, which
now,
is different.
Right. It is different. My advice, and people will disagree with me on this, but my advice is to always tell an officer if you have a firearm and if you have a permit to carry. I mean, quite frankly, if you have a firearm on you in the car, you better have a permit to carry. If you don't, then the firearm better be in the storage area and in a case and not loaded. So my advice always is to always tell an officer, keep your hands on the wheel, be very polite to the officer and tell them, look, officer, you pulled me over, that's fine, but I got to tell you, I have a firearm in the vehicle or I have a permit to carry and I'm carrying a firearm, because I think it's much better to be upfront with the officer rather than play some surprise thing.
All right. In terms of closing arguments, do they really make that much of a difference, do you think? And you've got some very high-powered attorneys here on both sides.
Right. Well, closing arguments only make a difference when it's a very close case. And that's why I said that's the last thing. Many times what makes the most difference is the defendant's testimony. In this case, the victim is obviously deceased, so he won't testify, but also opening statements. Because when these attorneys give an opening statement, that's your first crack at the jury to tell them what you think your case is about. And if you could sort of get them on your side rather than your opponent's side, that gives you an edge throughout the trial.
Right. And let's ask about Ms. Reynolds. Since this happened, Ms. Reynolds was actually charged with an assault charge.
Right.
Does that, because obviously she's an eyewitness, which is pretty right. unusual to have an eyewitness. Does that come in or maybe not, or how does that work?
I would not let that in, and I doubt the judge will. The only time something like that would come in is if she were convicted of that charge. So, for instance, if you're convicted of a felony assault, felony drug case, that means you're a convicted felon, and therefore, when you testify, the other side can what's called impeach you with that felony conviction. However, she's not been convicted. I don't know when her future court date is, but she hasn't been convicted yet, and who knows if she ever will. So I doubt the judge would say, yes, you can bring that fact up. Now, if she blurts it out or if she says something that she shouldn't say while she's on the stand and therefore opens the door to that
I issue, see.
That's a different thing.
Okay, because obviously her role here is enormous as well. Well,
it's
obviously,
enormous, right.
Yeah. Well, obviously everybody is going to be watching this trial and a lot at stake and a lot of tensions. I know that there are a lot of people outside the courtroom. I guess it's just a very, very tense scene. It looks like, though, the testimony will start this week. And do you really think it's going to take 2 weeks?
Yes, I do think it's going to take 2 weeks because on Monday they have to finish what's called their peremptory challenges where they're going to be removing 8 jurors. And then they have to go into their opening statements. I don't know how long that's going to be. And then the state does its case. And the state's case, I would imagine, is going to take the rest of this the next week. And then comes the defense. Plus, you never know if there's going to be some motion hearing in the middle of it because some piece of evidence is greatly disputed. So I would think 2 weeks.
All right. Well, listen, Joe Tamburino, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on this Saturday evening.
Thank you very much. And have a good weekend.
Absolutely. Take care. Thanks, Joe. All right, folks, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to get another report from CBS News on this attack in London that, according to some reports, has left at least one person dead on the London Bridge. It is an evolving incident there that people are looking at, a very confusing, chaotic situation there. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have that CBS News report, and we'll also have some weather for you. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 6:34 or 6:35 on a Saturday evening, 86 degrees, folks. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with our studio coordinator, Jonathan Lowe, who's been really helping out here, negotiating and kind of making sure that we get all these CBS updates. From the latest in London, there has been what appears to be a terrorist attack. There are multiple fatalities, according to multiple news outlets. A truck jammed, ran right into a group of pedestrians on the London Bridge, the famed London Bridge. There have also been a series of knife attacks as well. We will have another update, live update, from CBS News on what appears to be yet another tragic terrorist incident. But this half hour, we also want to visit the issue, and certainly has been enormous news this week, that President Trump announced that the United States would in fact be pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And it has created reverberations and really, I think, shock and dismay from many other countries, from environmentalists. However, supporters of President Trump are rallying around him, saying he actually made the right call. Joining us right now is Jessica Hellman. She's a professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Minnesota, and she actually attended the climate talks in Paris in 2015. Professor Hellman, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Let me ask you, first of all, let's just go with the real basics here. What is this Paris climate agreement, this global agreement that I believe almost every nation in the world signed on to, with I think the exception of, I believe it was Syria and Nicaragua? And please, you know, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right. This is a great question because it's really important to actually what the Paris Agreement is all about. And so I'll give you a little bit of a backstory. For about 21 years, the international community has been getting together every year to agree on the terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And in the 21st year of those gatherings was in Paris. And that at that meeting, we reached an agreement where everyone said the goal was to stay below an amount of climate change of 2 degrees Celsius, so a global average warming of 2 degrees Celsius relative to the historic sort of baseline condition. So it was an agreement on what the goal should be. And it didn't, interestingly, it has no binding targets. It doesn't penalize anybody for not living up to the promise. It's an agreement and a goal. And then the agreement invites countries to come back together every few years and up their individual commitments toward reaching this collective goal. And it's a very different approach than had been used. People probably heard about the Kyoto Protocol, which was a previous agreement that had been reached that the U.S. never signed on to. And it did have binding targets. It also didn't require China and India to participate, at least in the early stages. So this Paris Agreement was a completely different approach than what had been pursued in the past.
And, you know, in terms of how long was this in the making?
Well, the Paris Agreement, that's a terrific question, too, because these negotiations go on for years. There was a lot of fuss in when this conference happened in Copenhagen. We thought maybe folks will remember that. We thought maybe an agreement would be reached that would be the Kyoto Agreement had expired and was no longer relevant anymore, and we were looking for a new agreement. So several years in the making. It didn't end up happening at Copenhagen, and then a couple of years later, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes talk to work toward the Paris Agreement. The world had to decide that 2 degrees was a reasonable goal, that it was a balance of achievable and actually prevented catastrophe from happening. There's a lot of concern about runaway climate change, that if you let the global average temperature go above a certain amount, and 2 degrees is a good guess, a good limit to that. If you let it go over that, then climate change will get away from you and you won't actually be able to stop it from happening.
All right. What, in your opinion, Professor Hellman, is the consequence, obviously there are many, of President Trump's announcement?
There are two possible completely different consequences. From my point of view, they're both not favorable for the United States. So I think the scientific community and the global community is pretty confused what the upsides are of pulling out of this agreement. But the two fears are, one, the whole agreement falls apart. And so the 2-degree goal doesn't get met. And we end up with more climate change than 2 degrees C. And that could be a climate change that threatens billions of people around the world, threatens agriculture, causes global instability, sea level rise, all the stuff that we are trying to avoid in this by having an international agreement. So that's possibility number one. And that would be the case because the U.S., we call it the second biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Over time, we have been by far, through history, the biggest emitter. So if you don't have a huge player participating, it's going to make it hard to make the goal. The other big fear is that the rest of the world, the agreement doesn't fall apart for everyone else. They work really hard to achieve the goal, and there's a lot of innovation and new rules and international economic policies that happen, and the U.S. wouldn't be part of that. So this is where you hear this idea that the world will buy its solar panels from China instead of the United States. So fear that we'll miss out on a global economic shift.
In terms of the future of the accord, obviously the president is obviously the president pulling out. I mean, is there any latitude to re-enter the agreement at a later date?
Yeah, in fact, it takes time, and I'm more knowledgeable about the climate side than I am about international treaties, but My understanding is that withdrawing is not something that happens overnight. And also, this is that annual meeting, that gathering of the countries, continues to go on every year. So there will be continuing discussion around the world about how to tackle this problem. But the sort of confusing thing about pulling out of Paris is that you're pulling out of a goal. You're not pulling out of binding commitments. So it's kind of, it's telling the world that you don't share this ambition of stopping climate change. And that's the part that seems confusing. I mean, the Trump administration has a lot of latitude about how it would go about participating in the Paris Agreement, even if it stayed in. And it could be much less aggressive. It's the Trump administration had signaled that it was going to be much less aggressive than the Obama administration had. But to pull out altogether is to say we don't want to be part of tackling this problem.
My guest is Professor of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior at the University of Minnesota, Jessica Hellman. She attended the climate talks in Paris in 2015. Let me ask you, and I know that there are probably people, many people out there listening right now who are among those who really are skeptical of climate change. What do you as a professor, as a scientist, what do you say to them, just in general?
Yeah, I think this has been a confusing thing. And there are lots of parts of climate change science that are confusing and hard to wrap your head around. But there are some things that are very, very simple. And the simplest thing, something we've known for well over 100 years, is that there are certain chemicals, CO2 is one of them, as is methane and nitrous oxide, that they trap heat. And when you increase the amount of them in the atmosphere, it traps more heat and it makes the average temperature of the world go up. That is just, there's just essentially nothing disputed about that. Now, the complicated part is when we start to figure out what does that mean for, what does it mean for us in Minnesota in July? The specific details, and then, of course, a really tricky part is how much CO2 are we actually going to release in the future? What are people going to do? There's more uncertainty about people than there is about the climate system. So there's just really not any uncertainty about what a greenhouse gas is and what a greenhouse gas does. But there's plenty. I always say, I always tell students, for example, that there's plenty of good controversy to be had about how to tackle this problem. There's just not as much controversy as you hear in whether or not there is a problem.
All right. But yet it's still out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation that's being perpetuated on purpose. I think sometimes we confuse policy with science. So why we still debate the science when we need to be debating the approach? I personally think it's really interesting because the science is not partisan. It's not political. CO2 doesn't care about Democrats or Republicans. And they're on both sides of the aisles, different ideas about how to solve problems. So, for example, there's lots of evidence that suggests from economists that a free market approach, that uses capitalism has lots of really good solutions to this problem. And so we actually need all different political persuasions thinking about what is the right approach to address this, because we got to push our economy in a new direction. And, of course, there's plenty of ways that people could make money in renewable energy. We're already enjoying some of the fruits of that in Minnesota. And one of the concerns about pulling out of Paris is that we could lose that momentum.
Professor, what are some of the figures or the statistics or the scientific evidence that you really point to that really screams out there, absolutely, folks, we need to look at this?
Well, that's a great question also. So there are a couple of key pieces of evidence. One is just chemistry. Like I say, we've known for well over 100 years exactly what these chemicals are and how it is that they absorb heat and trap heat. So that's just the sort of laws of physics, if you will. But then if you want to start asking, have we increased the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere, then you look at a different line of evidence. and you look at measurements of CO2 in the atmosphere, and we have really good measurements of that, and we can see how it has changed. So that's one line of evidence. Another line of evidence is we know that when you burn fossil fuels, it releases these compounds, and we can measure that. Then you might ask, how do we know that humans have changed the climate? Well, we have long-term records of climate even before people existed using ice cores and tree rings. And then, of course, we have the record of temperature around the world. And it's actually not any one of those things that tells you is the right answer. It's the fact that they all basically tell the same story. All the measurements around the world taken by lots of different people, different models made by different scientists in different countries, all show the same signal. So for it all to be wrong, you'd have to have basic chemistry be wrong. You'd have to have wrong measurements. We'd have to have some fundamental misunderstanding about how our planet works. So it's sort of the sum total of all that evidence that I think makes it so convincing to the scientific community.
Let me ask you what it was like to be at those accords, in the talks back in Paris in 2015. It must have been pretty extraordinary.
It's really interesting because it's called Conference of the Parties, or it's called COP for short. And then we count through all the years. There's one each year. So the first meeting was COP 1, COP 2, so on and so forth. Kyoto was, I think, COP 7, perhaps. So Paris was COP 21. So the people who actually get to make decisions are the diplomats for each of the countries around the world. And it's just really interesting to watch them discuss the different language of the agreement. And there's a lot of the language in the agreement that has to do with how frequently the parties will get together to change their ambitions, wording about certain risks confronted by different countries, different lots of fine print, if you will. And that's all negotiated by these diplomats. But part of the Paris meetings or any of these conference of the parties, the special privileges to attend go to observers. So university people, non-governmental organizations, so nonprofit groups are there, tribal groups, all kinds of different people with different stakes in the game, political groups. They can go, they're not part of the debate, but you get to watch it. And so as part of the University of Minnesota delegation, I got to participate. And then there's a kind of meeting on the side where experts get to meet with colleagues and talk about their scientific results. So it's like a big climate science party as well as international negotiations.
Well, listen, Professor, I want to thank you so much, Professor Hellman, for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you. Okay. Thanks for your interest in this.
All right, absolutely. All right, folks, in just seconds, we are going to get a live update on the situation in London. There are multiple casualties. There are apparently, according to some sources, multiple fatalities as well. An incident in London, several incidents in London. Here now is It is 6:53 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with studio coordinator Jonathan Lowe. We are monitoring, as is CBS, the latest in what appears to be a terrorist attack in London. CBS News reporting multiple deaths, many people injured. There are reports of three separate locations for this attack. One, a white van plowing into a crowd of pedestrians on the London Bridge, the famed London Bridge. There are two other sites of separate attacks. They appear to be coordinated. The British authorities have not yet released definitive details. It's not clear how many people, if any, are in custody. Again, CBS News keeping us updated. President Donald Trump has been briefed. The president has put out a couple of tweets in the past 40 minutes. The first being, quote, "We need to be smart, vigilant, and tough. We need the courts to give us back our rights. We need the travel ban as an extra level of safety." The second tweet, which was about 28 minutes ago, quote, "Whatever the United States can do to help out in London and the UK, we will be there." And in caps, "We are with you. God bless." Interesting point in that first tweet, the suggestion that the travel ban could help protect the United States from incidents like this. Of course, we don't know who committed these acts. Were these, in fact, British citizens, and that has been the case, people who are legitimately in Britain. And so we don't know about that. The president's travel ban struck down by another appeals court just, you know, within the past couple of weeks. They say that the administration says they will be taking it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I will get Dave Schultz to weigh in on that. But obviously the president reacting through Twitter, his favorite medium, really, to communicate exactly his personal thoughts.
There are going to be people that do not like me for saying this. And give my opinion on this. Well, while the president's tweets were, I think they were appropriate to say, and there was nothing wrong with them necessarily, he has to flip those. He has to flip the order. I think you have to, I know that the first concern is looking at how you can protect the people that you are supposed to be leading. I understand that. But I think you got to show compassion first, and then the tweet about the travel ban can come out. Again, I know that there are a lot of people out there that are not going to like me saying that, but I think you had to flip the order of them.
This thing is so fresh and so raw, and I mean, I'm on British websites right now. It is still chaos there. They obviously don't know who is the suspects here are. It's difficult to believe that the president already knows that this is somebody who has immigrated to the United Kingdom, and we don't know that.
And you look at what happened with the Manchester attack a couple of weeks ago. I believe that gentleman was at the very least a British national, if not a British citizen.
Right. Anyway, so the president doing that. Obviously, the situation is unfolding. I will tell you folks that we are going to be getting updates from CBS News at the top of the hour. We're also going to take it at 7:20, 7:50 as well. But keep it here, folks. Much more ahead. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. Esme Murphy, along with Jonathan Lowe and, of course, the CBS News team. Keep it here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.